standing at the station and I'm waiting on my train to come. Well, I'm standing at the station and I'm waiting on my train to come. I can't stand around all day, you know I gotta run.
Hello, I'm Todd DeFeo, publisher and editor of RailFanning.org. I had the opportunity to interview Matthew Algio, whose new book tells the true story of Alfred Beach. Beach secretly constructed America's first operational subway beneath the streets of Manhattan in the 1860s. The book, New York Secret Subway, The Underground Genius of Alfred Beach and the Origins of Mass Transit, is out September 30th. I hope you enjoy this discussion.
Well, thank you again for taking time to chat with me.
You're welcome.
Yeah. Really just wanted to hear about your book that's coming out and how you got interested in this topic.
It's funny. This is my eighth book, and I often get asked, how did you find the story? Where did the story come from? And usually stories just sort of seep in. You don't really notice it the first time. But this is a book I can give a definite origin story for. It was during the pandemic in 2020, and I spent a lot of time on Spotify. And I was listening to a progressive rock playlist. I like prog rock, you know, yes, Emerson, Lake and Palmer, stuff like that. And the band came up on the playlist named Klaatu. They were a Canadian prog rock band in the 70s. They had a song called Calling Occupants of Interplanetary Craft, which the Carpenters then covered to some success. But on this Klaatu album, their first album that had that song, the backside of that single was a song called Sub Rosa Subway. And it tells the story of Alfred Beach building a secret pneumatic subway in New York in 1870. And it begins back in 1870, Alfred Beach works secretly. And I looked this up and I couldn't believe the story. This guy built a secret pneumatic tube subway, the first subway in New York in 1870. He had to build it in secret because Boss Tweed would never let him build it officially, legally. And the more research I did on this, it was one of those stories that it was hard to believe that that it wasn't better known, and B, that there hadn't been more written about it. And that's the first obstacle you have to overcome when you hear a story. You're like, this is the greatest story. This would make a great book. And of course, if you go do the search on Amazon or whatever, it turns out somebody wrote the book 2 years ago. But this was one of those cases where nobody had ever really written. Nobody had written a full account of what Alfred Beach did in 1869 and 1870 to build this demonstration line, a short pneumatic tube railroad right under Broadway, right in front of City Hall in New York. It just struck me as a amazing story and really worth looking into.
And maybe it's because I tend to gravitate myself towards the obscure, the lesser known, the little stories in history that, again, just for whatever reason, have just fallen by the wayside. We've lost them. It always strikes me how many of these stories there are out there, like you're saying, that we should have known about. And it's almost as if its history is just hiding in plain sight. Were you surprised? It sounds like you're surprised that there wasn't written about.
Yeah, I was surprised there wasn't more written about him. But also, in the context of New York City, talk about an amazing history, right? I mean, from the founding of New Amsterdam, the Knickerbockers, the Dutch, the fight. There's so much history in New York that there's bound to be some of these stories that kind of fall through the cracks. I think Alfred Beach, who developed this project, this subway, was really ahead of his time. And I think that hurt him as well. It was just seemed such a quixotic idea at the time that a lot of people didn't take it seriously. And of course, ultimately, I guess it's not a spoiler to say there is not a huge network of pneumatic tube subways operating in New York right now, but he was on the right track, so to speak. And I think so much is happening in America at that time, and so much is happening in New York at that time. Remember, New York is bursting at the seams in the 1860s and 1870s. After the Civil War, millions and millions of people are emigrating to New York, millions of Irish immigrants, millions of Italian and German immigrants. So it's really a transitional time in New York. And I just think there's so much happening and there's so much interesting history about transportation in New York, the history of the subways and the history of the elevated and the early history of the streetcars, that it just got lost in the shuffle. That happens sometimes.
It makes you wonder too, how different New York might have developed over the years had something like this come into place. If, you know, had it taken over, had it been really successful, how maybe other cities would have implemented something similar to this. Do you have any thoughts on that piece of it?
Yeah, I mean, New York would have been the second city in the world with a subway system if this had gone through. There were so many obstacles that Alfred Beach faced trying to develop this system of his, this subway system. One was political. You know, the political bosses, Tammany Hall, the Tweed Ring, Boss Tweed, they were all in cahoots with the streetcar operators who held monopolies, held franchises on the different routes in the city. In fact, Tweed himself was on the board of the Third Avenue Railroad Company, one of the streetcar companies. So there was Tweed's job was to keep all competition at bay. And since he controlled all public works in the city of New York, he made sure that there would be no competitors to the streetcar. So that was why Alfred had to build it secretly to begin with. Then there was the corporate opposition, the landowners on New York, especially in New York, especially along Broadway. They were all afraid. Well, they said they were afraid that a subway tunnel would undermine their buildings, like literally the buildings would collapse. Of course, we know that's not the case. What they were really worried about is that subways would take pedestrian traffic off the street and away from the front of their stores, and that it would cost them business. So they opposed every public transportation proposal for Broadway, basically until the 1890s, they finally got streetcars. And then the third obstacle that Alfred faced was the technological one, just the hurdles, he had to develop a tunneling shield specifically to build this tunnel. Obviously, it was a great feat of engineering just to build a 300-foot-long tunnel under Broadway. If it had succeeded, and eventually he did get a charter to build it, but that wasn't until about 1873. And by then, a financial panic had swept across the country. There was no funding. And then the tunnel just sat there for years and years. It is interesting to think that even if he had just built what he wanted to build, which was a single line up Broadway, it would branch off east and west side, south of Central Park. Even if just that had been built, it would have changed the entire trajectory of the growth of New York. You would have seen vast development of Upper Manhattan much faster than occurred. Basically, that was delayed for at least 10 years, maybe even 20 or 30 until the subways came. And you also wonder if he had built it on the pneumatic principle, well, in just 10, 15 years later, then the electric motor comes along. And then, of course, you know, that made subways much more feasible. But New York already would have had a subway to easily to switch over to this better electric system. So they already would have had that infrastructure in place. So it really was a case of, I think, the politics and business interests conspiring to keep this innovation from taking hold.
It's a shame. And it's always interesting too. A lot of these folks who have that vision, they don't have the vision for the timing piece of it, because you mentioned 1873 was just terrible time. It's interesting the time frame that so many of these visionaries were operating in. And if only they could have seen the foresight into knowing what might have been around the corner, that also might have shifted.
Outcome. You talk about being before your time, but really this was a case, if Alfred Beach had done this in 1875 instead of 1870, it really might have worked. Because by 1875, we're recovering from the financial panic. Jay Gould tried to corner the gold market in 1873. You know, they were always having these financial panics in the 1800s. And there was always another one around the corner. But his window was too short in 1870 when he started. If it had been delayed maybe another 5 years, it might have had a different outcome. I'm not saying it would have been completely successful and be covered in these. But something would have happened much more considerable, and probably he would be much better remembered.
It's interesting too, because you mentioned about the memory piece of it, and you know, certain elements of it I think are still known or better known. Boss Tweed's a great example. I think generally people know the name. We might know the name, but maybe we don't know the details of him. We might have forgotten a little bit about him. And it's interesting, I don't know if you have any thoughts on this too, but how some people, maybe because he was more involved in so many more aspects of the city and the city's growth. But it's interesting how they stand the test of time as characters. Again, maybe some of the details are a little bit lost as to what they ultimately did and some of their impact, but they're remembered when aspects like this, you know, subway is forgotten.
It's a shame because really Boss Tweed is the bad guy in this. And sometimes it's the villains who are better remembered than the good guys. And that's definitely the case with Boss Tweed. I mean, he was so corrupt that there's a courthouse that he had built while he was Public Works Commissioner. He was never even mayor. People always assume Boss Tweed was mayor. He wasn't mayor. He was a state senator. And then he was on the Public Works Committee. He was on the Streets Committee. I mean, he had his fingers in many, many pies. And one of his projects was building the courthouse, a new courthouse, county courthouse in New York in the 1860s. It began, it took like 20 years and ended up, it cost like twice what we paid for Alaska. There was so much graft in it. I mean, plasterers were getting paid $10,000 a day in 1870. You know, it was preposterous. But New Yorkers still refer to that building. It's still there. It's now the City Department of Education. They still call it the Tweed Courthouse, right? Because he was so notorious that his fame seems permanent. And Alfred Beach, his background was in newspapers. His dad was one of the early in innovators in the penny press. He didn't found it, but he bought very early the New York Sun and turned it into one of the first penny papers. It had stories about crime and romance serials and things that appealed to the common everyday guy. And Alfred had worked on his father's paper for a while, but he didn't. It was a pretty vicious occupation at the time, being a newspaper publisher. Took a lot of hits, and I don't think Alfred really had the constitution for that. So when the Scientific American magazine came up for sale, he purchased that when he was very young and really channeled his energies into American innovation and American invention. So he was a very good promoter. He understood. And when the underground subway, when the pneumatic subway came along, he was very good at promoting it. But he wasn't a flashy guy. I think he was essentially a pretty low-key, humble guy. And I think that also prevented him from becoming more famous, especially later in life.
It's interesting, too, the cyclical nature of history. I'm thinking about some of the, you know, the bad guy. It's like kind of like the movies, right? Sometimes the bad characters are the ones that are most remembered.
Sure.
And the corruption piece of it, too, we realize how cyclical that is in politics. Sometimes we think this is a modern invention, but when you go back and look at so many stories in history and so many errors in history, you realize it's not new, that it's really been around for a long period of time.
Well, look at them trying to build a high-speed train between San Francisco and Los Angeles, and the politics and the business and the corporate interests all involved in that. And overall, we think politics today are terrible, and they are. The fact of the matter is politics have been terrible for a long, long time. And we've been through some really rough periods where things were very, you know, confrontational or combative. I mean, we had a war, for crying out loud. So you definitely go back when you look back at stories like this, and it's really cool. I mean, I love doing the research, and you go in the newspapers and you see all the other things that were happening at that time in politics and culture and entertainment. And in a lot of ways, it's all very recognizable to us. Like I said, the idea that I think about congestion pricing in New York, right? That they're trying to implement this system, and just the fierce opposition that it's faced. And you can have, obviously, they're perfectly rational opinions on both sides of that issue, I think, but it just shows you the contentiousness of some of these issues that Alfred Beach was kind of getting involved in. When you say, okay, I want to make a new public transportation system for the biggest city in the country, well, you're going to ruffle some feathers. And there were a lot of feathers to be ruffled back then.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Aside from the Boss Tweeds of the world, how was the concept received? Were people excited about it once they found out about it and learned about it?
Yeah. So it opened in February, March of 1870. Alfred built this tunnel. It was 300 feet long. It was underneath Broadway from Murray to Warren Street, which is right by City Hall. It was operated as a pneumatic tube. He had a large fan or a blower that would blow this passenger car on rails to the end of the tunnel, and then it would suck it back. And when he opened the doors to the public in 1870, he charged 25 cents a ride, just a ride to nowhere down the block and back. But thousands and thousands of people paid it. He donated all the receipts to an orphanage, by the way. So he was also pretty shrewd that way. Got some good publicity. People loved it. People loved it for a couple of reasons. One, no horses. The amount of horse poop on the streets, New York, in 1870 is staggering. And there were 10,000 horses just pulling streetcars. That's not the other horses pulling wagons and private vehicles and people just riding their horse up and down Broadway. This, of course, operated on the pneumatic principle. No horses were involved. Not only that, no steam. You know, the first subway opened in London in 1863, but they were pulled by steam engines. Now, a lot of the tunnels were open. They were cutting, you know, they were just cut. They weren't covered, but there were tunnels and there were stations underground. And so all the steam and soot was very uncomfortable and sometimes unhealthy. So it was clean. There was no horse poop. And since it was 20 feet underground, it was always comfortable. Not too hot in the summer and not too cold in the winter. So it had a lot of things going for it as far as the, you know, ordinary public transportation passenger of the day. I mean, public transportation was horrible. They had stagecoaches they called omnibuses. They had horse-drawn streetcars. So filthy and crowded and filled with pickpockets. And these were all monopolies on the route. So there was no incentive for any of the companies to improve services at all. So really, there was a great deal of public support for Alfred Beach's pneumatic subway. And he took thousands of petitions that he had signed to the state capitol in Albany. He had to get permission from the state legislature. He had to get a charter from them. That was the difficult step in this process. But I think the public loved the idea.
Fascinating. Was there ever revisited at any point after it was developed and after the panic subsided? Did anyone ever go back and look and say, this is a great concept, or the technology has moved in a different direction?
It did. The technology moved in a different direction because in the 1880s, Werner Siemens was a German engineer, and he developed one of the first electrified streetcars. And then I need to look all these names up, and you probably know. What was this? It was in Richmond, the first electric streetcar system went in, and there was the guy who invented that. But anyway, these electric motors that could operate streetcars on rails came into fashion in the 1880s. So again, if Beach had built the pneumatic subway, my own feeling is that it would have probably been electrified pretty soon after. You had to have these giant fans at every station or every other station to make it work. And it was also, you could only have one car in the tube at a time. So a car could only go from station to station. Then you went to the next station, then a car could go to the next station. Of course, with electrification, you could have cars going constantly in both directions. And so I think the concept was definitely appreciated and understood even after the fact. But once the electrification came in and people saw that as a better way to move forward with the subways. And then the subways were finally built in New York, I guess in 1903, the first line opened, I think. And it was nice to look in the papers. There were remembrances of kind of the old timers. Look back to the Tweed days when Alfred Beach had this crazy idea for a pneumatic tube subway. So he did get some recognition in the end for the idea.
Sometimes I think it's easy to forget just the pace at which technology was moving in that era. Sometimes I think maybe where we're sitting today, we tend to think technology's never moved as fast. And that's like politics. That's also a misnomer. And this era in particular is incredible, the pace at which new ideas were coming about and being implemented.
One of the things that really stood out to me when I was researching this was the development of the phonograph, which happened right about this time. And the idea of recording a human voice to us seems so ordinary. But at the time, the idea that your voice could outlive you, that after you were dead, people could listen to your voice, I think that that would have blown my mind. And I think it really, it was a development that I think really touched people or hitted people in a way that we just don't appreciate because, of course, we're taking for granted all these things. You know, Alfred Beach in 1869, 18, there's no electric lights. He's using zirconium lights or whatever it is. They have gas lights. There were no electric lights at the time. People lived in darkness, even at night. The gas lights weren't very bright. So yeah, this was a period of incredible technological change. I like to point out in the period from Alfred Beach was born in 1826 and he died in 1896. So it was 70 years. Well, the year he was born was the year the very first photograph was taken, widely attributed in 1826 that the first photograph was taken. Of course, by 1896, we're starting to see moving pictures. And of course, sound is being recorded by that time. We have telephones coming in. Of course, the telegraph has come in. You can have instant communications. Alfred Beach, when he was older, had a telephone line installed from his church to his home so he could listen to the services on Sunday. So this was a period of incredible technological change, like you said, and we take it for granted. But I think they were just as terrified of the phonograph as we are of artificial intelligence in some way. It was baffling.
It's incredible when you think about that. And I think, too, when it comes to railroads, just sort of broadly speaking, in subways, I mean, we're so familiar with subways today. Even if you don't have a subway in your town, you're probably familiar with the New York City subway or a subway anywhere else. And just the ability to move from point A to point B. I mean, we always talk a lot about mobility, so always a hot topic in any city. But just the idea that you could, you know, build a tunnel underground and you could take people potentially for blocks if you, you know, really built it out. And I'm sure when the first subways opened, it was that same kind of thought, just that how much that would change life, just being able to get somewhere quickly.
People, a trip from Central Park to City Hall could take hours in New York, even if you were walking, because the streets were so impossibly crowded. Just crossing Broadway, sometimes it was simply impossible. You couldn't do it. The traffic was so thick. There are no traffic control devices. Of course, there's no traffic signs. There's no stop signs. It's not even yet universally agreed which side of the road people should be driving on. So it was just chaos, just wall-to-wall traffic and vendors everywhere, selling corn on the cob and oysters and just madness, the chaos of it. That was the other thing that appealed to people was, yes, if we build a tube underground, I mean, the idea of getting from Central Park to City Hall in less than an hour was unfathomable to people at the time, you know, much less doing it in 10 or 15 minutes. I mean, it was inconceivable to them. So yeah, it's one of those things that, like you said, we're all familiar with it, but we don't really stop to think that, oh yeah, there's a cemetery above my head right now. Oh, there's the Empire State Buildings above my head right now. You know, there's a whole city up there. But I also want to mention people were a little freaked out by it too, because going underground was, you know, it was akin, that was where the devil was, right? I mean, there was a lot of superstition about tunneling underground and what would happen. And people weren't used to traveling in dark, opaque tubes. I mean, people traveled on trains out in the countryside. You saw the whole world going by. That was one of the glories of riding the train. And now you're in a little tube and you couldn't see anything outside. It was a little frightening to people, intimidating.
That is, I hadn't thought of it that way, but yeah, it is incredible. I think you can look at railroads, and I'm a railroad person, and so I'll admit that right away. But it's interesting because you can really look at railroads and they really are a window into us, our society, who we are, throughout every era of history, from the earliest days to even today. You can make that same argument. It's just, it really says a lot about it. And you can see, I wonder, curious if you found this when you were looking into this story, as it's being developed, you can really see, you mentioned like the superstition piece of it, you can see all these different thoughts and people's different perspectives coming together and sort of converging on this one topic.
It was interesting too, the competition between the idea of, you know, you could have railroads at grade, which they had in New York at that time. You know, they were just big old steam engines going down Fifth Avenue or whatever, and, you know, and just stop traffic, and then have a guy in front of them wave a flag to get traffic out of the way. And you could have railroads going underground, but there were a lot of fears about that that I talked about. And then there were the elevated railroads, which presented their own problems. You know, people who lived on the second floor of all these buildings suddenly weren't crazy about the idea of an elevated railroad when everybody could see in their windows. And the first elevated railroads, if you go look at some of the pictures of them, they're terrifying. They look so spindly and they're going to collapse at any moment. So there were people that were scared to ride those because they were afraid they were going to fall off the tracks. So, yeah, it's a very interesting psychological aspect to it, too, about which mode you're going to choose. And the idea that people were scared to go underground was kind of fascinating. I hadn't thought about it either.
A lot of curves in some of those elevated trains too, that also made them equally dangerous. I think there was a couple notorious ones where it would be going along and then suddenly make a, you know, a sharp turn one direction or the other, which maybe we've gotten a little better in some of the engineering over time.
Yeah.
Some ways we haven't, I guess. I don't know. It's open for debate.
You learn some things the hard way, definitely. Engineering and public transportation. Yeah, some of the early trains were dangerous. And like I said, I think the public, to actually see this thing going up, as opposed to Alfred Beach's tunnel, which suddenly appeared out of nowhere one day. Wow, this is amazing. It's finished. It's beautiful. It's clean. It's airy. It's lighted. But for the elevated rails, you just saw some guys putting some steel poles in the ground or iron poles in the ground. And it definitely made you think twice about whether this was going to work or not.
It's incredible to think back. I think we forget that about New York too. We think of today, all right, there's subways, makes sense. We have it, but we forget all the different types of you know, streetcars, elevator trains. I think we just forget how robust that network, the network is still robust, but how much more robust it was once upon a time with different types of, or if they had stayed, you know, how different it might look today even.
Yeah, the elevated railroads really won out in the end. I'm talking of like by the 1890s, there was a great picture I love. It is in Scientific American, I think 1879, but it's an illustration, but there's just a little horse car going by underneath this towering elevated train at 110 and 8th Avenue. And it really demonstrates how these elevated trains just completely took over, replaced the streetcars. But then in another 30 years, the subways came and really replaced the elevated trains. The only reason the elevated train succeeded as the dominant form of public transportation in New York from roughly 1870 to 1900 is that all the alternatives just got defeated. You know, the subways kept getting defeated everywhere. Proposals to run the trains at grade, you know, finally people just threw up their hands and said, just put them up in the sky. It's just the easiest, the path of least resistance is what it was. And so they were, you know, the developers of the early elevated trains just kind of lucked out in a way.
That's interesting. That really is interesting. Anything else that really struck you that was really surprising as you were researching that you couldn't believe maybe when you first saw it?
I think the idea that pneumatics and pneumatic tubes and transportation using pneumatics was a viable, highly believed in prospect. I mean, you go back to the early experiments of in England in the early 1800s. They were experimenting with tubes just to send transportate or to send goods, you know, just small tubes. And of course, we still have some of those in, you know, in the bank when you go to get the pneumatic tube, suck your thing in. A lot of marijuana dispensaries use pneumatic tubes because it's easier to have a secure room in the back where somebody sits with all the product. And then you just shoot it up to front and then they shoot the money back and then you put it in the safe. It's a little bit safer that way. But really, there were plans, there were ideas to build. I mean, Alfred Beach wanted to build a network of pneumatic tubes across the country that you would be shooting from New York to San Francisco, over or under rivers or over and through mountains. It really was an appealing alternative to horses and to steam. And like I said, it really got usurped by electrification, and the development of the electric motor did what all the advocates of pneumatics wanted it to do, which was make a clean system of mass transportation. I would say that surprised me how popular pneumatic tubes were. And I hate to go back to the poop, but the filthy condition of New York streets in 1870, in the 1870s and 1880s, really until the horse got replaced, it's just inconceivable to us. So no matter how dirty you think New York is today, believe me, it's like an operating room compared to what it was 150 years ago.
I was just thinking that we might be complaining about it today, but we don't think of the idea. I mean, there are still some horses that, you know, you could take the carriage rides around, regulated differently, no doubt, than it would have been then. And no doubt you're making an effort to clean up after them.
It's also kind of amazing to think that just about everybody knew how to ride a horse, you know? They had to know how to ride a horse, right? As soon as you're little, they had to teach you how to ride a horse. They got to take my horse there. Anybody could ride a horse. And in New York, everybody knew how to ride a horse. Everybody knew what horse poop smelled like. They were stepping in it every day. I mean, people's connection to that was, it's really kind of mind-blowing that in pretty much 20 or 30 years, that just disappeared. People went from knowing horses, knowing how to ride a horse, knowing how to care for a horse, knowing how to hitch a horse up. And then basically by 1910, 1915, maybe, nobody knew how to do that anymore.
You just must have assumed, too, that the city just smelled like horses.
Yeah.
You still thought that's what the world just smells like, because that's all you knew.
That was another reason people liked the subway and liked the Alford Beach subway, is because, especially in the summer, it didn't smell. Was terrible.
That's a remarkable thought when you think of the bonder.
And not just, not going to get not fixating on this, but not just the poop, the pee too. There's gallons and gallons of it in the street. And this stuff was a great disease vector, you know, for typhus and stuff like that. I mean, it was really unhealthy, and they had periodic campaigns to clean it up. But it was like, you know, I don't know, what is it, pushing the stone up the mountain? I mean, you were just never going to get it all taken care of.
Even when we think back on history, I don't think we think of all these aspects of it. I mean, it wasn't just, okay, things were horse-drawn, so you think, oh, okay, it was slower. That was an element of it for sure, but you forget the ancillary benefits and the, you know, detractor, you take it away from it.
And how much feed these horses were required, transporting that into the city every day. The infrastructure just around the horse, there were stables everywhere. I mean, they had a stable on every block. Just a completely different world that we kind of, well, it's impossible for us to kind of comprehend it, but how different it was. So, yeah. And then it just all vanished.
This has been a fascinating conversation. Any other thoughts, parting thoughts on your book that you want to make sure to point out? And obviously I'd encourage everybody to go get it. It's such a fascinating story.
Yeah, definitely, please. And I think, you know, rail fans will definitely appreciate it. I'm a novice in the subject. I've always loved trains, always have. You know, but I'm not a rail nut by any means. I don't say that derogatorily. And I know I'll have a couple mistakes in there that I'm sure some of your listeners will be quick to point out to me. But I really think you'll find it. I think it's an interesting look of, like you had mentioned earlier, about how transportation, and particularly trains in this case, kind of are a reflection of the greater culture or the issues going on at the time. And I think it's interesting to see it in that light.
I don't know that I know anything about rail fans either. I just happen to have a website, and I went crazy on the topic. I wanted to take one picture about 25 years ago and get it published, and it was such a bad picture that nobody would publish it. So I started a website.
Start your own publication.
Exactly.
Never get rejected.
That's right. I hope you enjoyed this discussion and will check out Matthew's book. For more unexpected tales from the rails, please subscribe to the Rail Fanning Review podcast. For railfanning.org, I'm Todd DeFeo. Be sure to visit railfanning.org for more news, features, and photos from the rails.